Hey, it's Andrew, the Director of Literary Arts. Here at Literary Arts, we rely on our community, people like you, for support. To help make this podcast and all our programming possible, give today, literary-arts.org/donate. Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 35 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project is provided by Cole Haan. Cole Haan's shoes, bags, and outerwear go with you while you work your way to extraordinary. More at colehaan.com. In this episode, we feature Ta-Nehisi Coates in conversation with writer and activist Renee Watson. Ta-Nehisi Coates is the author of the best-selling books The Beautiful Struggle and Between the World and Me, which won the National Book Award in 2015. Coates then went on to publish We Were 8 Years in Power, a collection of essays from his years at The Atlantic magazine, including the article The Case for Reparations. That piece proved so powerful that it helped rekindle a national debate that led to the historic congressional hearing in June 2019, including testimony from Coates himself, of H.R. 40, a bill that would establish a commission to study reparations. In addition to his work as a journalist and essayist, Coates is also the current author of the Marvel Comics The Black Panther and Captain America. In October 2019, Coates published his first novel, The Water Dancer, taking his career in yet another exciting direction. The Water Dancer was an instant number one New York Times bestseller and an Oprah Book Club selection. The book draws on his previous nonfiction and comics writing to create the bracingly realistic and fantastical story of Hiram Walker, a young man born into slavery and in the process of discovering and harnessing a mysterious power. The Los Angeles Times described The Water Dancer as, quote, a spellbinding look at the impact of slavery that uses meticulously researched history and hard-won magic to further illuminate this country's original sin. Coates envisions the transcendent potential in acknowledging and retelling stories of trauma from the past as a means out of darkness. Coates begins the event with a short reading before sitting down to talk with Renee Watson. Here's Coates.
Thank you. Thank you. Renee, I don't know if we talked about this. Was it okay if I read from here?
Of course.
Okay, all right. We didn't have a conversation. I realized maybe I was supposed to sit down.
No, you're fine.
Okay, all right. Wow, I was listening to, you know, all of the introductory remarks, and I was very happy to hear that there are a number of high school students here. That's always exciting news. But if I can just be a little small for a moment, I didn't realize the Portland Trailblazers had anything to do with me being here. I saw that shot Damon Lillard hit. And my wife, she says, you know, there are two types of people in the house. Like, there's normal Ta-Nehisi, you know, just settled, you know what I mean, kind of even, you know, straight up. And then there's sports Ta-Nehisi. And I saw that shot, and I grabbed my wife. I said, oh, baby, did you see that? You see what just happened? Deep Space Dame, man, you know? That was something. I'm not here to talk about basketball. I'm here to talk about The Water Dancer. It's my first novel. I have to say, I don't know if there are any other aspiring writers in the house. I say I always, even now, consider myself an aspiring writer. Because every time you start something, it's another lesson. And you have to learn how to do the thing all over again. Certainly, for a first novel and to be a first-time novelist to be, you know, greeted with this much enthusiasm is breathtaking. So I thank you very much for being here. The Water Dancer is the story of an enslaved man by the name of Hiram Walker, a young man. His father is the owner of a plantation. His mother is an enslaved woman who has been sold off by his father, no less. Hiram has a deep and preternatural photographic memory. If he were here right now, he could recite everything that I just said and all the introductory remarks that came before that and tell you everything that you said. But his memory fails him at the thing that is most intimate to him, and that is the loss of his mother. He says at one point in the book, he talks about how he sees everything in colors and in shapes and in textures, but when he thinks of his mother, all he sees is words. He knows what's happened to his mother because the community in which he's invested in tells him, you know, what's happened, but he can't actually picture that. And part of his struggle is the connection of pain and trauma to memory and what it does to memory and how we deal with that and how we push things into, as he says in the book, the down there of the mind. But Hiram is not the only character dealing with trauma in this book. There is a young lady by the name of Sophia who is also enslaved. And she's enslaved to the relative of Hiram's father, so Hiram's uncle, actually. And when this person, Nathaniel, is in residence, he has Hiram bring this woman, Sophia, over. And when she comes over, she has to, you know, go through this whole routine of dressing herself up as though she were an upper class lady. Hiram's gone for a period of time, and then he returns, and he, you know, has to, you know, do his duty. And he's having a conversation with her about what she did while he was gone, and how that made her feel. I will say that one of the things I was trying to do with this book was get into the interiority of the enslaved. To take us to a place where we were not simply talking about what had been done to black people in this country during a period of 250 years of enslavement, but what black people themselves did, how they felt, what their mindset was, what the experience was like. And so this is Sophia describing to some extent what the experience was like of being enslaved to another man and not having possession of her body. I spoke up and said, "How'd you get here while I was gone?" "Walked," she said. "You walked all the way here?" "I did, with my costume and effects. Thank God for Thena. She watched over my daughter, Caroline, that weekend. Only had to do it once, but I tell you, when I got that call, I was a mess, but I did it. I fit my face, I fit my dress and my unmentionables right over there behind them bushes. My God. Of all the things I done did, that was the one that left me feeling the most slow. Had to strip down to what God gave me in them bushes, afraid of who might walk by and what they might do. All I could do was sing to myself as I did, sing low and quiet, sing for courage. Then Sophia breathed out long and heavy and said, "Don't you ever doubt that I hate them. Don't you ever doubt it." And as she said it, her face shifted into an executioner's mask. There was no furrow or raised eyebrow, no spread of the mouth, no light in her dark eyes. Her face mirrored the truth of the hate she now spoke. She shook her head and said, "The things I would put on them, Hiram, the things that I would be capable of. You see me here now in this small body. Why, if my hands, my arms were as those of men, what I would do with my energies. I have thought of it, you see. I have thought of it even in this body. My God, what I would do while he slept with a kitchen blade or a tincture in his tea or white powder in his cake. I have thought of it very often. And well, then I had my Caroline, and that was that. And I am a good woman, Hiram, I tell you, I am. But what I would put on them given my time, what I would put on them." Thank you.
I'm so glad that you started with that. I definitely want to talk about their love story, really. Okay. And the humanity that is in this novel. Mm. So we're going to get to that. Mm. But first, I just want to know, how are you doing? How are you? So much has happened that we're all kind of watching this book take off and Oprah chose it for her book club, and it's hit the New York Times bestseller list. Is it sinking in that, you know, this book has done what it is doing, and how do you feel about all of that?
I need some time to process.
Yeah.
It's like I said. I mean, you don't. I'm so happy to see you guys, but I don't think any author can ever take for granted an audience. Mm-hmm. No matter what the audience was for your last book, you just never know. And this one, having worked on it for so long, certainly when I started it, this was not the expectation. Mm-hmm. You know, it's so funny because I always, you know, joke with my editor, like when we were writing this, I mean, you just never know what's gonna happen. There's no way we were like, this clearly is an Oprah's book club.
Right. No, you weren't thinking
you just,
that.
You just know. I mean, I don't know how you do that, but yeah. You know, we certainly didn't have that in our head. So it's been a lot, but a lot of good.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about what made you say, I'm going to write fiction? I mean, I know that it is 10 years in the making, so Between that time, other books came out, and we know you for your journalism and your essays and for Black Panther, and then now fiction. I'm like, you are a writer, which is a beautiful thing. Mm-hmm. Like, you're not just, I write novels, I write, right. You know, essays. You are a writer's writer. Can you talk about that risk, or did you feel that it was a risk to, like, put something new out into the world after we got to know you kind of in one vein?
Yeah, thank you. That's very kind of you. I really appreciate that, especially that part about being a writer's writer. So when I started, so this comes out of my first book, it was a beautiful struggle. My editor and my agent, after I turned that book in, suggested that I try fiction. Mm. There just was no way, like I didn't really have a large audience then. So that, like I didn't have to think about, like I didn't think this was gonna happen. Any of this, like everything that came with Between the World and Me, Case for Reparations, all that, it's very, you know, difficult to actually say this is going to happen one day. So the benefit of that is, no, I mean, I never felt that I would have to, you know, take a risk in front of a bunch of people because there was nobody looking at the time. And then by the time it really happened, which I guess would be like Case for Reparations 2014, mm-hmm. I was like 5 years in by then.
Right.
So it was too late to turn back at that point. You mm-hmm. know, I knew what I was doing in private. I want to take a second to answer your question, though, specifically about the origins of this book beyond, you know, the actual suggestion. Mm-hmm. I think I went through a period of study in the Civil War, circa 2009, 2010, and one of the things that became apparent to me, there were many lessons, but one of them was that people always talk about how the Confederacy, the Army of Enslavement, won the war of history. Mm. That is, they were able to remake themselves up as something other than people who were fighting for the right to sell other human beings and to expand that right, mm-hmm. Which was the core of the, you know, Confederate cause. And somehow they were able to inscribe themselves with a kind of nobility, you know, as though it was like King Arthur and Camelot. And you see this all through your culture. I mean, if you think about the vast, vast majority of movies that you've ever seen about the Civil War, or in, you know, invoking the Civil War, usually the Confederacies or the Confederate soldiers are some defeated, you know, person who's kind of tragic but courageous and mythic, and only tangentially, if at all, ever related to enslavement. And I couldn't for the life of me understand how a group or an army that fought for such a horrible cause came to be imbued with such a glamour. Mm-hmm. And it occurred to me that these folks had not just won the war of history, they had actually won the war of aesthetics. They had won the war of who gets to be beautiful and who doesn't get to be beautiful. And I mean, even sitting here thinking about this now, I think that's one of the things, or what is parcel to being oppressed. It's not just socioeconomic deprivation. It's what is held up as beautiful, as heroic.
Yes.
And that was put in the sharpest relief for me for the Civil War. But I think there's a, you know, a broader statement that can be made about that. Mm-hmm. And so when I went to write, I was consciously trying to do something different, you know, to construct a different myth, to write, you know, or to throw myself, you know, into that war of aesthetics. Now, and I promise to be brief.
You're fine.
No, I know you got questions, and I'm like giving a speech here. Defending my dissertation, you know?
Yeah, we want this. This is what they came for, so.
Now, one of the problems with that, though, is other people have, I think, that's not an uncommon thought, right? Mm-hmm. But see, one of the things that you always have to watch against, and I tried to in this book, you know, successfully or not, is you can't take white mythology and paint it black.
Yes.
Because white mythology has all sorts of assumptions that we probably should not carry with us. Mm-hmm. So to take it back.
We definitely shouldn't carry.
We really, really shouldn't. Yeah. We really shouldn't. So to take it back to, you know, those sorts of stories about, you know, this sort of, you know, lone, you know, hero, you know, mm-hmm. from the Confederacy, oftentimes these stories are told where someone has done something to this person's wife. Mm-hmm. You know, raped and killed, and then, you know, the guy goes to avenge him or something like
right.
that, you know. And the wife is never really much of a character. The wife is that person's honor. Mm-hmm. They're that cause. And I think given, because of the fact that slavery and rape are so synonymous in this country, mm-hmm. there is a deep temptation as a black man writing or engaging in that war to just take that and do the same thing. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
And you gotta watch it. You gotta be really, really careful. Mm-hmm. You gotta be really, really careful. That's just one. I mean, there are others about violence also.
Right.
You know what I mean? That shouldn't be imported. But you really have to make a new myth. You can't just insert,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, well, you did that well. I mean, that's, for me, reading this, I was so moved by the thoughtfulness mm-hmm. that you had towards Sophia. And the women, all of the women in the novel are whole people. And not just a caricature of an enslaved person. And they have dreams and goals, and we get to see them speak up for themselves and talk about what they want and mourn and be just human in a way that sometimes in movies and in other books, we don't get to see black women be whole people. Mm-hmm. And so I really appreciate that. And I was curious, as a man writing these characters, what did you do to be able to do that so well? Like, what's the practical writing thing that you did to, like, get the women right in this book and not do the whole hero thing, even though it is a love story? He doesn't come save
right.
her, you know?
Right. And in many ways, repeatedly is saved.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had a lot of help. I'm not lying. I mean, it's one thing to know you want to do that.
Right.
But even if you have it as an intellectual ambition, which I had the ability to execute it, mm-hmm. you need good readers. I am probably preaching to the choir here, but we are in an era where people who are infatuated with their own intellect.
Yes.
Like to stand up and say, well, we don't need diversity. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't need this. We don't, you know, great person with my great brain can just sit here and figure mm-hmm. it out. You know what I mean? And, you know, if you had a great brain too, you could do the same thing.
Right.
You know, but, you know, this is not about anything, you know, particularly, you know, in the bones or anything. It's just that people have different experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're trying to write yourself into other people's experiences, you know, maybe you should have some of those people reading and, you know, offering some, you know, critique to your work.
Perhaps.
Maybe. It's actually quite simple.
Yeah, it's actually very simple,
it's actually
right?
It's very, very simple. It's actually very, very simple. And so, so I had a lot of help. You know, I had a lot of help. I had help. We had, at the time, two editors, Victory Matsui and Nicole Counts, who were editors who read and offered comments. Mm-hmm. You know, my wife always reads, you know, what I'm writing, and, you know, she'll offer comments. So I had help. I mean, that's the biggest, yeah. you know, thing.
I appreciate you saying that. I mean, we have a lot of writers in the room and a lot of aspiring writers, and I think sometimes it can look like someone, they wrote the book, and that this is the
right.
book that you wrote the first draft.
Right, exactly.
But it's never that way,
it's
right?
Never that way.
And so I appreciate you being honest about, yes, you have help, you have readers, you're going back and going back and going back again to get it just right. And
right.
I feel like, I mean, clearly you did that because it sings. And singing, speaking of singing mm-hmm. and music, I know you have a playlist. for the book. I saw that you, and I love that because I write to music too, but I feel like so many writers don't.
I don't know.
You have like a whole soundtrack to this book.
I do. I played it while I was writing, a different. If you went over the 10 years, I got like 5 of them, you know what I mean? But it'll be different for different people, but I've heard, they say, well, the words get in my way.
Yeah, I'm like, really? It helps me with the mood.
And yeah, so it does. It totally does.
You know, thinking about just, I want to do some craft talk too and just talk to you, writer to writer. You know, okay, so you reach out to people, you got feedback, you have this playlist. Can you talk about how music influences, impacts your writing? What role does it play in your life as a writer and as a storyteller?
I mean, I think I am always trying to use words to get past the words. Mm. Like, you almost want people to forget that they're reading. And then just get as imbued in it as possible. And so I'm always trying to figure out, how do I get to that? You know what I mean? And a lot of times in the music, it's there, like the feeling is there. Like the thing I think about, I say this all the time, but I think about like Distant Lover, you know what I mean? Marvin Gaye's Distant Lover. Mm-hmm. And I listen to that and there's something, I mean, the words are great, that's fine.
Right.
But there's something in how he is communicating the words that is almost indescribable. And what you're trying to do when you're writing is you're trying to conduct or convey that feeling out of you through your fingers into the words, and hopefully it reaches the person. But you have to feel it first, because if you don't feel it, there's nothing to give.
Right.
You know. And so if anything, I probably use the music to get to the feelings I'm trying to get to. You know. And then once I feel it, I say, okay, this is how I felt, da 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 da. You know, just describe it.
Yeah. So the first paragraph, if you have not read it yet, is a long sentence.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that. I love this idea.
Can you call Oprah and tell her that?
That I love it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll call her. Give me her number. You got her number?
We'll call her right now. No, because she hates it.
Oh, really?
I shouldn't say that. She said it.
That
it was hard, very hard for her to get past.
I appreciated it because I feel like, and I read it. So I read it the first time, and then I went back once I got to the end, and went. I always do this and go back to the beginning to remind myself, how did this story start?
Right.
And I feel like, oh yeah, like you set us up for the tumbling down, the movement, the water, all of that felt very deliberate with the comma and the comma and the comma. And this, it's intense. You're not pausing and taking a breath, because in so many moments in this book, there is no pausing and taking a breath.
Right.
And so I wonder, like, was that intentional? How do you think about the placement of words actually on the page?
No, that's a great, great question. That sentence is only in the last draft.
Okay.
Of the book.
Mm-hmm.
So in all of the drafts, that sentence is not there. That scene is there, but that sentence is not there.
Mm.
And I think this is the advantage of writing and rewriting.
Right.
Because I knew how, I was like, okay, this is how it ends. So now I really know how to start.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, I'm absolutely clear on where this story goes. So I know exactly how to start to achieve what you actually said. That once you get to the end, if you so chose to go back, you would see it. It would all be laid out right in front of you. And really for that entire section, you know what I mean? I was just trying to say, this is what the story's about. It's all here.
Mm-hmm.
It's all here. And if you ever went back and looked at that section, you could see, my God, it was all there.
Yeah,
you know,
it absolutely was.
It was all laid out.
I think about that because also poetry is like one of my, it's my first love. And I know
mine
that
too,
you love poetry. And I think about, like, poets think about word placement and line break and stanza and all of that. And sometimes I feel like, when writers are writing fiction or prose, maybe they don't pay as much attention to how to actually structure this paragraph, or what do the words look like on the page, and how are those words gonna evoke a feeling and an emotion. So I also wanted to ask, how does poetry impact, or it, I shouldn't say how, does it impact your prose, and can you talk a little bit about the relate, like what can fiction writers learn from poets?
I think people who write prose in general, and I might be wrong about this, but I feel like people generally regard what they consider beautiful or lyrical writing as a kind of side course.
Mm.
And then you had a story.
Right.
You know, you have character, you have plot, all those sorts of things, you know. But the way the sentences sound is something that's always considered over there. And I don't feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and maybe that's, as you said, I mean, I started off as a poet. I started off reading Carolyn Foché, Yusef Kumanyaka, mm-hmm. Sonia Sanchez Baraka, like that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And so how things sounded is very, very, very important. It carried information. Mm-hmm. I have a tough time reading anything where people don't think too much about how the words actually sound, mm. where they think what they're saying is enough.
Yes.
But, and I felt like this about nonfiction too. Mm-hmm. Like, I felt like if I were writing something like Between the World and Me or The Case for Reparations, yeah. you know, it was not enough for somebody to read it and say, that seems correct. Mm-hmm. You know?
It's the facts of something.
Yeah, the facts yeah. of something. Yeah, that seems, you know.
Yeah.
You were trying to get to something here. Mm-hmm. You know, you were trying to haunt the person. You know what I mean? You wanted yeah. them to, like, get up from it and to be disturbed and to, you know, have to walk around a little bit or call a friend. And then, you know, yes. when they went to bed, they were thinking about it and they woke up thinking about it and they mm-hmm. couldn't shake it. You were trying to get to that deep place back in their brain mm-hmm. and just sit there. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you can't do that by just being factually correct. Mm-hmm. You can't do that by just telling a tidy story.
Right.
You know, I actually think it's the language that allows you to burrow in,
yes.
you know, into people's brains so that they you know, sentences stick with them. Mm-hmm. And they just have trouble forgetting it, you know?
Right. Well, it's like the song, like a lyric of a song.
It's exactly like
sticks
that.
With you.
It's yeah. exactly like that, yes.
I want to talk also about your research. Mm-hmm. I know that, well, and we saw that you did so much taking in of people's stories. And in so many ways, I mean, that, you know, that's what you're supposed to do as a writer. I also know that it's a lot to take in other people's stories mm-hmm. and that these aren't just stories, right? That mm-hmm. I mean, we're connected to these stories. And so I wanted to know how you take care of yourself. And what does it mean to be in a black body mm. reading these narratives, mm. then having to tell the stories, mm. and then have to live your life? Mm. And how do you balance taking in so much pain and not carrying that with you? Does that make sense?
It does. Believe it or not, the writing is a tremendous relief. Mm-hmm. You know, I've said this before, but what was always troublesome to me about America and white supremacy and racism was not just the fact of the thing. I mean, the fact of the thing is bad, but it's the, what do they call it? The gaslighting.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's the lying. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the, no, that didn't happen.
Yes.
You know, and once you get to this place of where you feel like, no, it did.
Right.
It really did.
Absolutely did.
It absolutely did. You know, it almost, I won't say that the white supremacy doesn't matter, but the lie begins to not matter a lot. And that mm. is a tremendous relief mm-hmm. to realize that you're not crazy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
You know,
like, I know that feeling, yeah.
You know?
For sure.
Look, being poisoned is bad, but someone telling you poisoned yourself?
Mm-hmm.
And you having to sit there and think, did I poison myself?
Right. When did I do that?
When did I do that?
How did I
don't
do
remember that?
That.
I don't recall. There was somebody who was slipping something in my drink. I swear I saw that.
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean?
And I swear you saw it.
Right. I know
you were sitting
saw
with
it.
Me you, and
were
you saw
right
that
there.
Happen.
You saw it happen.
Yeah.
I know you did. And to like get the like video camera footage to extend the metaphor.
Yes.
Where you see the person
proof.
Doing it.
Yeah.
You know, that's what writing is like for me. So mm. it is the writing is not so tough. It's all the Ooh. Other stuff.
Well, what's the other? What do you mean by that?
I mean, just like the fact of having to live in it.
Yeah.
You know, is the difficult part for me. The writing is an escape. It's where things are true. It's where, you know, I feel like I've achieved some level of understanding.
Mm-hmm. We have a lot of young people in the room tonight, mm-hmm. which I'm so happy that so many young writers are here. Can you talk to them for a moment, and especially our aspiring writers who are here and they're like, I want to be on that stage one day reading from my book.
Wow.
What is some advice that you would give to them?
Don't aspire to be on this stage reading from
Yes. And why? Can you talk about why? Yeah. Why is that not the dream and the goal?
I mean, listen, and I hope nobody takes it. Look, I'm very happy you all are here. I really am. But I'm gonna say this as politely as I can. It's not for you. And honestly, I don't think you would be here if I wrote it like it was for you. I don't want to bear witness to art that is solicitous of me. You know, I come to art to see the person express something that's deep, deep inside that they pulled out, you know what I mean, and rendered in some sort of beautiful fashion. And so the first thing I would say is, you know, write for yourself, you know. That is different than, you know, what some people say, which is don't be open to critique. That's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying that at all.
Yeah.
I think critiquing, you know, finding a good group to offer critique is really, really important. Mm-hmm. But some of the worst writers, and maybe not the worst writers, some of the most unhappy writers who I know are writing because they aspire to be on a stage in front of a crowd like this. And that's bad mojo. It'll drive you to do some really, really unhealthy things. I write because it brings me tremendous joy.
Yeah.
You know, I have a simple life. You know, I have a family, I have friends, I have my writing. And all three of those things bring me tremendous, tremendous joy. So I would say, first of all, you know, if you're gonna do it, make sure you're doing it for the right reasons. Make sure you're doing it because, you know, you feel like you almost can't stop yourself from doing it.
Right.
You know, if you have that, I mean, you're very close to being at least a very good writer if you can't stop yourself. You know, I would say read as much as you can. You know, I said reread a ton. And I would say practice. I would say avoid the temptation to think, Renee, as you said, that writing just comes out like this, that, you know, somebody just wrote it down. You know what I mean? Understand that almost all writers, at least the ones I know, when they start off, their first drafts are terrible.
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 And they revise forward.
Yeah.
They revise forward. They don't start, you know what I mean, with as a finished product. You know, writing is not so much written as it's built. And if you can get to that, if you can deal with that, you know, you might well be a writer.
Can you talk about what comics did for you? I've heard you speak about this when you were younger, that's really what you were reading. And I don't know, I feel like sometimes comics, graphic novels get looked down upon or not seen as literature, and or maybe not the books that a teacher might hand a young person. Can you talk about how they impacted you? I mean, here you are today and you grew up reading comics.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, it's like my earliest notions of what story was, of what was beautiful, what was exciting. I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, how I came up. I was, you know, born and raised in the crack era in West Baltimore. It was not the funnest time, you know, to be living in, you know, American cities. And I think like everybody else there, you know, I was looking for escape. You know, and I found my escape in, you know, what I have no problem calling literature. I found parallels, you know, to my experience. I always tell people, like, I was a huge Spider-Man fan when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And I never thought of Peter Parker as white.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it never just translated in that way for me. I don't know why. I mean, I was aware how he looked, obviously, but I didn't think of him as white because he's a hero. He tries to do the right thing. The press hates him. People throw things at him, they boo him, you know what I mean? All sorts of terrible things. And you know, living in, you know, being black, living in West Baltimore in the 80s, I thought, I can see that. I get that. You know, it felt very close to me.
Yeah.
You know, it felt really, really close to me. So it's probably, you know, it's one of my earliest forms of literature.
Who are your superheroes when you think about like living people or people who are no longer with us? Who are some of your mentors or people who you look to for guidance,
strength? Wow, that's a long list. So, I mean, obviously in this book, for the way it was written, I mean, Harriet Tubman is probably the oldest, you know.
I can clap for real.
You
it's okay.
Clap for Harriet Tubman. yeah, that's probably the oldest, you know, because Harriet was from Eastern Shore of Maryland, and my family's from the Eastern Shore of Maryland. Yeah. I grew up in Baltimore, so there was a close, you know, relation there. Frederick Douglass, who had a huge impact on how this book is written. But when I was young, probably the one, and I guess, you know, because of when it happened in my formative period, probably the one that was the biggest for me was Malcolm X. That was And I think because even then, like, I was aware that there was like a kind of vocabulary for how people talked about Black people mm-hmm. and what emotions Black people were allowed to show.
Yes.
And this need to, and I can remember it even then, that we should always be forgiving of white people for whatever they do, mm-hmm. that we should be forgiving of the worst of what white America has done. And Malcolm's probably the first person I, you know, heard in any sort of public place say, man, F that.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And listen, you could debate back and forth whether forgiveness is correct or not correct, but that's not the point. He just sounded so human to me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he just sounded like, yes, I would be angry.
Right.
If somebody hit me over the head with a nightstick.
Mm-hmm.
I would be upset about that.
Yes, and that it's okay to say that.
And it's okay to say that.
Yeah.
You know? And so, I mean, even from the reading I read, like when I was writing Sophia, it was very important that she not be presented in her situation as this person who was sort of like, yes, but I know the Lord will find a way and everything
right.
will be okay.
Yeah, pray through it.
You know what I mean? Pray through it. I'm not mm-hmm. mad at him.
Right.
He know not what he do.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
You know, she said, I hate him.
Right.
I hate them all. And don't you ever doubt that I hate him. And if I could do something to him, I would do it.
Yeah.
You know? Because
yeah.
if you spent any time in Black, so you know Black people that feel like that.
Yes. And
yes.
Black women that feel
and
like
black
that.
Women
I mean,
that
I,
feel
that
like
is
that,
why
right?
I That's love. True. I love her so much because she isn't the, like, yeah, all the stereotypical roles that we see
right.
Black women have to play over and over of every tragedy can happen to them and they're still just gonna have joy in spite of.
Right.
And still,
right.
you know, love the man who is a right. complicated, flawed man.
Right, right.
You know, like, all of that, but forgive him and bring him back. And no, she's like, actually.
No.
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 actually,
no.
this is how I feel. This
no.
is what I want. You can't come save me. I'm not right. just, and that she's not just a body.
Right, exactly. And so it's like interesting because I mean, probably very good reasons for this, but I hadn't even thought about this because in that sense to write that, that was not difficult because that didn't feel very different than the Black women I knew.
Right.
So it wasn't like a stretch.
Mm-hmm.
Why that shows up in literature so often differently and in the culture so often differently, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I think has a lot to say about who is controlling the narrative and what our expectations of that
yeah.
narrative are.
Yes,
you know?
Absolutely, and the gatekeepers.
And the gatekeepers, yeah.
yeah. Which I think, you know, thinking about your editor and the fact mm-hmm. that you are working with an editor who is Black, and
yeah.
what does that, like, how has that impacted, you think, your writing, your career, the freedom maybe to tell the stories the way you want to tell them? And
yeah, so one person was Black, another editor was Black, and another was a Japanese American.
What?
Yeah, those are the
That's
three
like,
people.
That does not happen in publishing.
Yeah, those are the three people who had hands on this book, you know?
Yeah.
And only one of them was a dude. And so that, yeah,
yeah,
I mean, that'll have effects.
Yeah, are important, right.
Yeah, that'll have effects. I mean, I swear, not even from a charity perspective, but just
mm-hmm.
from a craft perspective, I'll just go back to this. I don't understand I can write anything and I don't need to talk to anybody
yeah.
about it. And I can just imagine myself as, I don't know, a Pakistani guerrilla fighter and I don't
mm-hmm.
need to know where Pakistan is or talk to anybody about anything. If
yeah.
I can imagine it, I can be it.
Yes.
You know, I don't...
No.
I mean, I guess. Maybe.
Well, I appreciate that you called people in and asked them, read
right.
this, help me do this thing, because you did it well.
Thank you.
You did it so well.
Thank you.
We're going to go to questions soon, but I wanted to honor our beloved Toni Morrison.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
I was in New York when you were with her and Sonia Sanchez.
Oh, really? You were there?
Yeah, I was there
wow.
and saw that moment, the three of you in conversation. What?
Wow.
No, I mean.
I gotta tell you a story though.
Okay.
I gotta keep it 100 here. I got that, and this is like, wow, man. You know what I think about? And this is like a lesson to me, and y'all gonna have to not crucify me for this. You know, I love Sonia, and I have been talking to Sonia. You know, Sonia had been such a big supporter and was, one of my early like inspirations in terms of writing poetry, and you know, after that, you know, to the literature I went on. And I don't even think I told her this, but when she wrote and asked me to do it, I was like, I don't want to do this. Mm. That was my reaction. Mm-hmm. And I had been having, believe it or not, such a hard year with Between the World and Me that I was like, I can't go out in public mm-hmm. again and do this. And somehow, I think somewhere in the back of my head, I was like, that's not right. you really need to go.
Yeah.
You really need to go. And it that night was so beautiful.
It was so beautiful.
You know, and then Jackie Woodson was there. I mean, it was so incredible that, like, it really was a reminder, you know, about, because I think I even felt this at the time, time is fleeting. You just don't know.
Yeah.
You don't know if you're going to get a chance to be on stage with Sonia Sanchez and Toni Morrison again.
Yeah.
Like, you shouldn't anticipate that, you know, necessarily will be there forever.
Right.
You know, but we all are, I mean, we are not always, you know, in our worst moments wise. You know what I mean? And again, this is why you need people around you, right? Like, it's why you need people around you. And that just, I mean, that was like one of the highlights of my career by far. I mean, it was just incredible.
It was a beautiful night. And I know, you know, she loved you and loved your words. So I just wanted to say her name tonight and share that moment with
you. No, she was special because it is hard enough to be a great writer. It's really, really hard. Even more difficult to be a great writer and to touch other people mm-hmm. and to, you know, kind of lift them up. I don't think Between the World and Me would have been Between the World and Me without Toni Morrison. I just don't. I mean, the book was there, but I don't think that would have went the way it went. Mm-hmm. I just don't. And everything after that flows. I mean, even to this book, even to being right here. So I am, you know, indelibly, you know, touched by not just her writing, mm-hmm. but her generosity of spirit.
Yeah. So for those of you who don't know, this is what Ms. Morrison said. I've been wondering who might fill the intellectual void that plagued me after James Baldwin died. Clearly, it is Ta-Nehisi Coates.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Yeah.
That's not small.
No, it's not small.
It's not small.
But yeah, I'm thankful that she saw that in you, and we're thankful that we have your words. So I hope you're writing your questions down, passing them to the ushers. I have a few that were already emailed in, so we'll get this started. But if you have questions, please send them, and I'll try to get through as many as we can. Our first question that was emailed in, what have you been reading lately that you would recommend?
Yo, I just read this book, American Spy. Mm-hmm. Do you know this book?
No, I don't.
Oh, so good.
Somebody does. Somebody's like, yes.
Yeah. And is it Lauren Wilkinson? Did I have that right? Yeah. Oh my God.
Nice.
It's so good. It's so good. And it's good, like, I have personal reasons for loving that book.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, my dad was in the Black Panther Party.
Yep.
And I was, you know, raised on, like, the knowledge of what the federal government had done to the Black Panther Party, and had done to the Black mm-hmm. freedom struggle, and Fred Hampton, and what they, you know, what the CIA had done in Africa. And this story is told from the perspective of, it's really a Black family
mm-hmm. Thank you.
That works in law enforcement and works in the FBI and actually mm-hmm. works on the other side. And it is absolutely fascinating. I mean, it is riveting. It's absolutely riveting. I mean, I can't say enough about it. It's a great, great book.
All right.
Yeah. Oh, and Jackie's book, too.
Red at the Bone?
Oh, that's great.
Oh, come on.
It's great. Yeah.
I mean, Jackie, for me, Jacqueline Woodson can do no wrong.
No,
but
she
that
can't.
Book,
that book is incredible.
It really is.
It's incredible. And I feel
incredible.
Bad because she sent this to me and said, yo, you're gonna blurb this. You know, again, in my own head, I'm like, I can't right now.
Yeah.
You know, but once I got done, you know, I love Jackie. So I said, okay, let me take a second and read the book. It's incredible.
Yeah.
It's an incredible book.
Yeah. Yeah, and another writer who's just so generous, too.
Yes,
with
Jackie
her
is. Very much so.
Time and advice and mentoring of up-and-coming authors, for sure. Can you speak to your choice of the word tasked versus slaves or enslaved in the book?
Yeah, so this actually is very, there are a lot of parallels here, but this goes back to where I was at before, where I was talking about, so in the book, for those who have not read, the word slave and slavery is in the book, but it's very rarely used. Instead, slavery is referred to as the task, and the people who are enslaved are referred to as the tasked. And a large part of that was not once again taking white mythology and painting it black. You needed new terms and new ways of thinking about it. One of the things, and I've said this repeatedly, and I'm just going to say it throughout the tour, one of the things I think about is how we're in this moment now, and we have been, I guess, for the past 20 or so years, where we no longer say rape victim, we say rape survivor. And it was a terminology that I myself adopted, but was not quite sure why I was saying. I was saying it out of you know, just respect. You know what I mean? Somebody asks, you know, for a particular name, out of just generosity and respect, you give it to them.
Right.
But when I was writing a book, I got like I began to see it. You know, because the typical terminology that we use in this country is slave, right? Like, that's what you've become. You've become, you are a slave.
Yeah.
Not you were enslaved. Not something was done to you.
To you.
You are the thing. You actually are the thing. And like, I started to see, like, it's a kind of evil to that, right? Because the society either does something to you, or it allows something to happen to you,
right?
Or it willfully neglects or whatever. And then it makes you the thing that somebody did to you. And so what that means is all of your identity, all of your humanity is annihilated. And you become the thing that society did to you.
Right.
And I just, I mean, I thought about that a lot in this book. You know, there's obviously violence in this book, but you know, there's one side that says if you're depicting slavery, you or enslavement, you have to show in great detail how horrible it really was. And I understand that. I don't want to argue against, you know, the depiction of that. But Sophia is in a situation where, as I said, her body is not her own. What does it mean to write, say, a 5-page rape scene? Like, what do you do? Are you now, you make the argument, well, I did that, you know what I mean, to show how evil this other dude was, you know, but what have you done to the person?
Right.
You know what I mean? Can, you know, the reader, as they go through the rest of the book, can they see the person anymore? Can they actually see them as a human being and all of the other things that, you know, make up them as a human being? And so in the effort to do that, I just, you know, you need new terms. Because I say slave and things immediately come to mind. You know what I mean? Immediately. Like, you almost, slavery is, or enslavement is the act of making somebody into a thing. And then you say the word and a person pictures a thing in their head. You know? And so the naming piece of this became very, very powerful and very, very important. I said this, you know, last night. That is a lesson. Because we're in this period right now. Where people want different names. And maybe all of us don't understand why they want those names. But maybe we don't have to understand right now. You understand? Like, maybe it's not for us to understand right now. Maybe you use the name out of respect. And then you'll get it. You know?
Yeah, and
little at a time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, maybe it's not for you to get. I mean,
that's the thing. Maybe it's not for you to get.
Yeah, right now, it's not time right now. This person is bringing a world of experience to their life.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And you cannot have been there for all of that experience. You know, and that's okay. That's okay. Does it inconvenience you that much to use a different name? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Does it really bother you that much?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Or can you just, you know, try to say it and then, you know what I mean, go on with your life.
Go on with your life.
You know? It's okay. You'll be fine.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you know what? Actually, in fact, the flip of this is maybe you won't be fine. Because maybe your power is dependent, or your identity is dependent on the power of the name. You know, I always, like, I think about, not to get too far afield, but, like, I think about how, like, folks who would oppose marriage equality, they would say, well, you know, if we, you know, pass this state measure, if the Supreme Court does X, Y, and Z, it changes the definition of marriage. And they weren't wrong in the sense that marriage to them means the right to exclude people, right? Like, some people, like, when they say, you know, marriage is between a man and a woman, What they're saying is part of how I define my institutions is keeping you out. You understand? And so in some sense, there's some people who won't be okay because their whole power is based on excluding people, you know, and keeping, you know, a foot on somebody else's neck, you know?
Yes. How has your family handled your success as a writer?
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I think it's really weird. It's really weird. I would go out on a limb and say I'm the person that has the most trouble handling it. I think so. I mean, we'll know more in about 10 years. But I think, look, there are no unalloyed goods in life. You know, there is no, you know, thing in which, you know, you get what you want and then you have no problems at all and everything's great. You know, life can't be strawberry shortcake. It's not like that. That's not life.
It's not life.
You know?
Ever.
And so I got way more than I could have wanted. You know, I mean, that's very, very clear to me. The same time, you know, you have to... Man, I was out. I did this thing in Seattle. But I can't believe I'm gonna tell this story. Oh man. Kenyatta's laughing. My wife's laughing. She knows the story. So I did this thing in Seattle, right? Uh-huh. And my wife, she's here for this, but she usually doesn't come. She'll travel with me. She won't come to the events, which is fine. You know, it's okay. And then we go hang out afterwards, right? She's seen me talk enough. So I get done with the event, come back, pick up at the hotel. We go, all right, we're going to have dinner, chill out. Mm-hmm. Just sitting, you know, nice restaurant, sitting back. This dude sees me. And he comes over, and he's, you know, a fan, right? Uh-oh. And he's really, and you know, and he talks, but kind of not, because we knew some people in common. And it's like 10:30, and I just want to spend the evening with my wife. He just went on and on and on and on and on and on and on. And on the one level, I'm like, can't you get the hint?
Yeah.
Right? But on the other level, I have to be real about it and say, listen, you wanted people to love what you did. This is what you wanted. You know what I mean? This is what you wanted. You don't get one and not, you know what I mean? Like, what do you want here? What do you want to happen here?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Like, there's no world in which you get everything you got.
Yeah.
And then someone is not so moved by it that they stand there and talk like that, right? Because they are moved.
Yes.
They are genuinely moved. Now, that's not what I've said in the moment after he left.
Upon reflection.
But upon reflection. And that's a difficult, like, that's, if there's any challenge, it's that. It's like, you gotta, okay, let me take a second.
Yeah.
I really did win. You know what I mean? I gotta, you know, be clear. You know what I mean? I won, you know, and not, you know, get into that place where, you know what I mean? You don't have clarity around the fact that all of this, as beautiful as it is, could disappear.
Yeah.
And you have to remember that. You know, you gotta stand in that space. Yeah. That's probably the hardest thing. Yeah.
Well, thank you. We're thankful that you came out.
That was Ta-Nehisi Coates from a Literary Arts special event in October 2019. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 35 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project is provided by Cole Haan on a mission to fuel your big ideas. More on colehaan.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Ligori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.